welcome to Women of a Certain Age And, with me, your host, Cynthia, creator and herbalist at Moonmade Botanicals. Since 1995, Moonmade has created high-quality, handcrafted herbal remedies that are good for you and safe for our planet. You can find out more about our products and me at moonmadebotanicals.com. Follow us on Facebook at Moonmade Botanicals and on Twitter at Moonmade. You can also sign up for my blog, where I post lots of recipes, of tutorials, DIY projects, pictures of my garden. Monthly newsletter, which you can also sign up for on the website, is also full of all that kind of information. And my mission from the beginning has been to offer herbal alternatives to bioidentical hormone products, specifically Premarin. And secondary mission, to help women, offer them alternatives to prevent hysterectomies whenever possible. And fibroids and cysts and heavy bleeding are certainly one of the things that I hear about most often in my practice, as well as vaginal dryness, which can make sex almost impossible, as any of you women who experience it know. And my guest this evening, Dr. Serena McKenzie, has been working in this area since 1995. She is a holistic physician, obtained her doctorate in naturopathic medicine from Basseterre University, and completed a family medicine residency at Basseterre as well in natural health. Her background is in primary care with an emphasis on the integration between conventional and complementary approaches. And she is board certified in integrative medicine through the American Board of Integrative Medicine. And this is great. And she is also a sexual medicine expert and a nationally certified sex counselor through the American Association of Sex Educators and Therapists, which I didn't even know existed. And Dr. Serena is the medical director of the Northwest Institute for Healthy Sexuality, which addresses a wide variety of sexual concerns in women and men. And it is a multidisciplinary clinic that works in fluid collaboration with a multitude of providers at the Washington Urology and Urogynecology Center. Dr. McKenzie is a member of the Washington Association of Naturopathic Physicians, of the International Society for Sexual Medicine, the American Association of Integrative Medicine, an age management medical group, American Association of Sex Educators and Therapists, International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, and a founding member of the Naturopathic Academy of Primary Care Physicians. Quite a list, and I am so grateful to have her on my show this evening. Welcome, Dr. McKenzie.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's going to be really a pleasure to talk with you a bit about what sexual medicine is and how it's different from what women may think, because I guess I always assumed that sex medicine meant sex therapy. So why don't we start there with what is sexual medicine exactly?
Yeah, and it's a common overlap. Our specialties in sexual health have really expanded in the past couple decades, which is really fantastic. And sexual medicine is a medical specialty that aims to understand medical causes of sexual concerns, both for men and for women. And so it's a branch of a sexuality profession that is typically conducted by either a physician or a nurse practitioner or someone who's in the medical field. And that's different than sex therapy, which is essentially a form of psychology. A psychologist, a PhD trained physician, or not physician, a professional who has expertise in helping men and women with sexual concerns. And so sex therapy is talk therapy. And sexual medicine is the medical specialty related to sexual concerns. And I myself am licensed as a sexual medicine specialist. I'm a sexual medicine fellow through ISHWISH, but I'm also a sex counselor certified through ASECT. And so I do a lot of talking with people about sexual concerns, but my focus is understanding the medical causes and addressing those. And I often work in close collaboration with sex therapists. We have quite a few who are in our area, numerous, who are fantastic, and we also have someone in our office directly who I collaborate with very commonly.
Great. So I'm understanding that yours is the medical angle, but just to clarify for a moment, so this comes up for me whenever I've mentioned sex therapy to women. In a therapeutic situation, is it just talking? Perhaps sexual assignments? I mean, is that where you would go in sex therapy?
Yeah, sex therapy can be, you know, there's a lot of different ways that can look depending on what the concern is. And so people can attend sex therapy either as individuals, if they're in a relationship and there's conflict around sex one way or the other. Oftentimes couples will attend together, which can be, I think, the most helpful utilization of sex therapy. And many sex therapists are board certified as family and marriage therapists in addition. And so they really are relationship experts and helping individuals learn a variety of skills, whatever it is that's most relevant for them. That can be anywhere from learning to communicate better and improving intimacy in a relationship to specific exercises that are designed to help improve erectile function or improve arousal or orgasm for women. So there's a real wide variety of topics that are covered in sex therapy, and really just depends on the individual and what the specific concern is. But the idea overall is that it prevents cognitive behavioral changes to help improve sexual function either individually or in a relationship.
Okay, that makes sense, and thanks for clarifying that for me. And so what are the most common sexual concerns that you see in women?
In women, the number one most common sexual concern that presents in a physician's office would be low libido. Medically, we call that hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which really just means disinterest in sex. And so, it's a really big, complicated topic because our interest in sex is really complex, and it has to do with our physical health and our emotional health and our relationship status and our body image and our background and history and sexuality. So there's a lot of things that go into it, and it's not one thing usually, but a myriad of different factors that affect our sexual interest. And, you know, what I always spend a lot of time talking to women about is that usually they come to see me if their disinterest in sex is problematic. There's plenty of women who don't have interest in sex and who don't have any problems with that, and that's not a problem. There's no making a problem out of something that isn't a problem. It's really helping women who are experiencing conflict or relationship discord to find some solutions, to find what works for them. So there isn't necessarily a guidepost that we're trying to get everyone to. We're just, as sexuality professionals, trying to help people meet their own goals of whatever that is. Trouble with orgasm is another very common complaint that we see in the office, as well as pain with intercourse, which relates to some of the vaginal dryness that you spent a lot of time
related to dryness.
About.
So many women, in my experience, I would say 8 to 1, or, you know, 8 calls out of 10 are about dryness rather than hot flashes, which is what we all sort of consider as the number one complaint of menopause. But I would have to say that dryness and low libido seem to be the two things that I hear about, even more than hot flashes. And what do you think that's about? Why do we have so much vaginal dryness, and what can
be
done about it?
It does depend on a lot of different things. You know, women can have vaginal dryness at any age, and it's not always a menopausal symptom. And so for women who are younger, who are in their, you know, adolescence or early 20s, I see those women who complain about pain or dryness. Most of the time, regardless of the age, I always spend a lot of time talking to women about the importance of arousal for sexual activity. And I think there's certain periods of life when maybe we can take it a little bit more than others, but generally speaking, the vagina has some very specific physiological changes that occur with arousal that we really can't mimic any other way. And lubrication is directly related to arousal. And if we're not aroused, no matter what our age, dryness is a very common symptom. Now, there's a lot of other things that can cause vaginal dryness as well, such as side effects of medications. And after menopause, when our estrogen levels decline, vaginal atrophy, which is the decreased effects of estrogen on the vaginal tissues can cause some very severe vaginal dryness for some women that can be mm-hmm. problematic even if arousal is in place after menopause. And same thing for women who've had a baby postpartum. Women who are lactating or nursing young children can experience similar symptoms of vaginal atrophy that menopausal women do because there's mm-hmm. changes in our hormones when we're lactating that can decrease the effects of estrogen on the vagina. So it's kind of a long, whirlwinded answer that there are a lot of different things that cause vaginal dryness, but I think one of the most important pieces are looking at the overall health, side effects of medications, estrogen effects or lack thereof on the vagina, but most importantly, arousal is really a key piece, and you're correct to assume that low libido and vaginal dryness often are overlapped. And if sex is painful, we tend not to want to have it. And so
right.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg? It's usually a combination because women who are disinterested in sex, who are kind of making themselves do it anyway, tend not to be aroused. And sex without arousal can lead to very painful intercourse. And then it becomes a cycle because if it's painful and if it hurts, it's very normal to not want to do that again.
Right, and you can only tell your husband no for so long, as many women express to me.
Yeah.
So what is
yeah.
your protocol for women who are experiencing dryness specifically? Do you just prescribe a lubricant for intercourse, or is there some other method?
Well, it really depends on what's causing it. And, you know, whenever I have a woman who comes in who has dryness, I spend a lot of time kind of talking through all of these different things. What are the other status of health issues? Are there other problems? Is there mood concerns, depression? How is sex going overall? What's the relationship status? Do we feel comfortable talking to our partners about sex? You know, it's a very lengthy conversation to try and understand where that dryness is coming from, because we're going to be more effective at treating it if we're more clear. And a physical exam helps quite a bit because sometimes we can also have chronic infections, vaginal infections, bacterial mm-hmm. vaginosis, or chronic yeast that can cause pain and dryness. Mostly there's pain more than dryness when there's infections, but there can be a friction type pain that some women associate as feeling dry that can occur with a vaginal infection. And so, you know, there's a medical exam. There's looking at the tissues. We can tell quite a bit from the color of vaginal tissues as to whether they're adequately estrogenized. We also commonly do cultures, look at the discharge, do pelvic exams. So it's really a very thorough evaluation before I make any specific treatment recommendations. And it really does depend. You know, if there can be some consequences of oral contraceptive pills periodically. So we try to address whatever specifically is going on. But I would say that there are some common recommendations, and lubricants can be helpful, to be sure. You know, I think that the body's ability to self-lubricate is important and has, again, like mm-hmm. There's a different physiology that occurs with arousal. The back of the vagina actually balloons open a little bit. The cervix, if a woman has one, elevates, and the color and the lubrication of the vaginal wall changes in a way during arousal that we really can't replicate even with a lubricant or with anything else for that matter. And would we really want to? I'm not sure. You know, that's kind of a part of the intimate relationship that's really valuable. And so, you know, lubricants certainly can be helpful. No doubt about that. There's also a difference between lubricants and vaginal moisturizers, which are a different type of product. And vaginal moisturizers are things that we typically use every few days and can help improve just the moisture of the vagina, and that can help with lubrication for some women. And then there's, you know, of course, botanical suppositories and creams that can be useful. And for some women who are postmenopausal and who are candidates, vaginal estrogen can be enormously helpful, depending.
Yeah, well, I guess my Vital V would be considered, it's certainly an herbally based remedy to help heal dryness is how I'm using it for women who just feel so sore and shriveled up. But I think it's well known that many women struggle to have orgasms even in during their younger days, but does that, how does the orgasmic function change after menopause or during menopause?
Yeah, and there can be some definite changes in sexual function after menopause. And, you know, from my perspective, I consider menopause a very healthy, natural, normal transition. That's my mm-hmm. personal view. There's other views out in the world about menopause that are different than that. But in my perspective, our ovaries naturally start to decline in hormone production. Average age is 51. Between 50 and 52. And mm-hmm. when our hormones decline, every woman experiences that a little bit differently. And for some women, that decline in hormones can change the orgasmic sensation. A lot of women will start to experience maybe a less intense orgasm or an orgasm of just a different sensation. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, women will have a real difficult time developing the capacity for any type of orgasm. And I think that there's a lot that goes into that. It's not necessarily just our hormones, although, again, estrogen in the vagina can improve mostly lubrication, but it can improve sexual satisfaction. We have a lot of studies that show that. And there's something called DHEA, which is a precursor to testosterone, and mm-hmm. there are some vaginal applications of vaginal DHEA that show, in studies, improved orgasm sensation. Testosterone replacement therapy is something that's not FDA approved for women, but is prescribed off-label quite commonly. And for some women, hormone replacement can make a difference in sexual function, but that's certainly not the only thing. And it's not hormones are not indicated for everyone. It's a pretty complicated topic as to whether a woman would be a good candidate for that or not. But the other part that I talk, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
The last thing that I was going to mention is our pelvic floor health is super important, and that tends to be overlooked a lot. Uh-huh. You know, by the time we reach menopause, many of us have had babies, quite a few babies, and our pelvic floor strength is something that does have correlation into our sexual function. And so for women who are experiencing urine leakage, incontinence, prolapse, such as a bladder or uterine prolapse, these are all symptoms of pelvic floor dysfunction, mm-hmm. and that has a huge correlation, I believe, to the orgasmic experience as well.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I work with a number of pelvic floor health practitioners regularly, and I had no idea what a huge benefit it could be to be in touch with that piece. And just going back to hormones for just a minute, what role does progesterone play in the balancing act of all of our hormones, would you say?
Well, from the traditional medical viewpoint, if you're looking at it from gynecology land, as I call it, which I spend a lot of my time in gynecology land, if a woman has a uterus and if she is on estrogen replacement, which is a systemic form of estrogen, is very different than a local application of estrogen. So estrogen to the vagina does not have the same pros and cons as estrogen that we use to treat the full body. But if a woman has a uterus and is on estrogen replacement therapy, then the only time that we medically require progesterone is in that circumstance. Because the easy way to look at it is that estrogen is like makes a lawn grow. It makes things grow. And progesterone is like a lawn mower and keeps the lawn at a low-level growth. And so for women who are on estrogen and not on progesterone, they're at risk for what we call uterine hyperplasia, and that's just when the inside of the uterus can grow and become thick. So that's the only time that we really medically require progesterone. Now, if you're looking at kind of more of the subtle hormonal balances, there's definitely other applications for progesterone. And for some women who have PMS, who are still reproductive age, progesterone cream or an oral form of progesterone can help balance out some of those symptoms. For women who are postmenopausal symptomatically, sometimes they feel better on progesterone. It improves sleep for a lot of women. It can improve hormone balance. So there's a lot of wide variety of applications. The only time that women are really required to be on progesterone is to counterbalance the uterine growth effects of estrogen.
Right. Okay. That's interesting to know, because that's really the realm that I come from most often is, there's so many estrogens in the environment. Do we really need to add any in? Or is there some other way that we should look at? Is there some other direction that we can come to menopause from?
Yeah, it is definitely complicated. And, you know, everyone experiences estrogen dominance symptoms, if you want to call it that, differently. And, you know, I think that we do have a lot of estrogen exposure in our environment more so now than we ever have before. And yet what a lot of women are really confused by is that they spend their reproductive years being in a, you know, an estrogen dominant state, so to speak, of fibroids and endometrial thickness and heavy bleeding. And then when they get to menopause, they have vasomotor symptoms and hot flashes and night sweats and vaginal atrophy, which is the dryness in the vagina. And then they feel like, wait, I've been estrogen overexposed, and now I feel like I'm having all these symptoms from being estrogen underexposed. And how does this all make sense? And do I really want to add estrogen when I feel like I've my body's been overexposed all of my reproductive years? So it's definitely complicated, and I don't think that there's any one answer for every person. It's just kind of an individual equation.
Right, right. I would agree. It seems that does seem to be my experience too, and the women that I work with. So do you work with women who have fibroids and cysts and that kind of thing? Is that part of the work that you do, helping relieve that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of my practice.
Yeah, because fibroids, boy, it just seems like so many women have them.
It's true. It is so true. A lot of women have fibroids.
Yeah, I might include it, and I have eaten well and stayed away from foods that seem to be problematic. And honestly, it baffles me how I ended up with this thing. But
yeah, and that's really common. And, you know, it's like one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking to women about in terms of fibroids, it's not your fault. You know, these are extremely common, and they're a type of benign muscle growth, so to speak. And they can be inside the uterus, they can be outside the uterus, they can be in the walls of the uterus, and they're so extremely common. And I think if we are aware of estrogen in our environment and whatever else, it's easy to feel like maybe we've done something wrong, and that, yes, fibroids are stimulated by estrogen, but by the same token, millions of women have them, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you've done anything wrong, and it doesn't necessarily mean there's anything you can do to prevent them. And I think for women who want to avoid, you know, medical interventions, they struggle with that because they really want to be able to will them away.
Right. Fibroids, do you think hysterectomies are needed in the case of fibroids, generally speaking, or just let them alone, or how do you feel about that?
Well, it certainly depends on the size and the type and the amount of fibroids. And if they're causing symptoms is really what it comes down to. If a woman is bleeding very heavily, and there are numerous other treatments to try for fibroids, there are some botanical therapies that sometimes can be helpful that help decrease the conversion of estrogen product in the body. And then there's also, you know, simple things like an IUD, a hormonal IUD, which is a synthetic hormone. They don't make it in a bioidentical form, but maybe eventually. And that can help decrease bleeding. There's also things like ablations and cryoablations and thermoablations, things that change the inside of the uterine lining that are a little less invasive than a hysterectomy. And, you know, it really just depends on where the fibroid is and how big it is and if it's causing symptoms ultimately, because if there's many women who have fibroids and maybe they have a larger uterus or it's an incidental finding on an ultrasound or something like that. And if they're not bleeding or if they don't have any other symptoms, then it's like, no, you certainly don't have to have a hysterectomy. And there are a lot of other things to try before getting to that level. For women who are bleeding through every medical or botanical therapy that we have, and if nothing else has worked, then often a hysterectomy really is the most appropriate option, but it's not usually where most women would start. And, you know, there's complications, of course, to any type of intervention. But I've had women almost bleed to death because they had opted not to have a surgical process that really would have been helpful. And I've had lots of women who are like, wow, I wish I'd done that hysterectomy 10 years earlier.
Recently talked with a doctor who removes fibroids and cysts, won't remove the uterus unless there's cancer. It was a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, and that's definitely indicated too. Myomectomy is when the fibroids themselves are removed and the uterus is left in. And you know, there's certain fibroids where that's an awesome option. And because I think when you remove the uterus, you know, you do change the pelvic floor and the muscles in the pelvic floor. Even if you leave the ovaries in, there is still a slightly increased risk of going into early menopause, even if those ovaries are left in after hysterectomy. So there's certainly consequences to it. And if a fibroid is, you have the right size and shape and location, that it can be removed through a myomectomy, I think that that's definitely preferable for most women.
Yeah. This guy was pretty interesting to talk to, and it was a man. Many men seem to not think it won't be so bad for women to have their uteruses removed, but it seems to me like it might hold things up too.
Yeah, it does. It does have, you know, I mean, our pelvic bowl, so to speak, is compact, and everything kind of fits in there in a nice, compact way. So removing the uterus can have impact, and, you know, not commonly, but every once in a while I do see a woman who complains that her sexual function just has never been the same after she's had her uterus removed. You know, so I think it does have impact, but generally speaking, most women tolerate a hysterectomy if it's indicated, if it's, you know, medically the best choice for them after considering other options. It can be completely life-altering, especially if you're on the verge of, you know, bleeding all the time.
Oh,
that's just miserable. And I have had so many women over the years who are just really grateful that they have that option. And, you know, I think so long as it's just, you know, very thoughtful and everything else has been explored and there's a lot of clarity as to why that's being offered, you know, hysterectomy can be a really fantastic option. But I certainly encourage women to think very thoroughly about what all their choices are.
Yeah. And so we just have a few minutes left because I know you have an appointment you have to go to. But what does a fantastic, you know, what is it that people who have fantastic sexual experiences have in common? What are the traits you found in those folks?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And it's an area of sexuality research that I think is really fun to study and to learn about. And, you know, there was a study done not too long ago called Optimal Sexuality. And they studied people who identified as having really fantastic sexual lives year after year after year, because having great sex, you know, in that first honeymoon period of a relationship is different than having great sex for the long haul in a relationship, which is
right.
A big difference. And so I think it's particularly of interest to study people who report having fantastic sex lives over time. And one of these studies that had looked at these individuals who associated themselves in that category found that they had traits that a lot of people are usually surprised by. They actually listed their orgasmic response and their physical sensation to be some of the least important characteristics. And what they reported is the highest characteristics in common was a sense of deep intimacy and a really rich relationship emotionally with their partner, and a sense of adventure and risk-taking to some degree, of having just a level of excitement that I think the average person who has concerns about sex is looking for. And generally what I find for people who have really high sexual interest in life is that they prioritize sex and they spend a lot of time being good at it, is maybe a funny way to say it, but for whatever reason, if we intend to be really good at other things in life, we tend to practice and train and learn new skills, and for some reason we don't usually apply that to sex. And we tend to think that sex should just spontaneously be awesome forever. And a lot of people struggle with that. You know, 44% of our population reports a sexual concern. So that's really high. It's about half of our population. And so I think these kind of studies that look at traits that people have who are making it work year after year are really important. I tend to be a big believer in working towards something positive instead of just looking at the negatives in our life. And so
yeah.
I really like these types of research that shows people really enjoying relationships and enjoying each other, and the level of arousal then I think becomes much higher. And a lot of these sexual concerns that we have physically in terms of pain and dryness and erectile dysfunction in men takes a really different perspective when we're in that space. Did I lose you? Hello? 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 Hello?